glad to see all who are with us tonight again. We appreciate your presence at the meeting and ask you to remember the concluding meeting tomorrow night in the will of God again at 8 o'clock. And we're still considering the life and ministry of Elisha. And we have quite a number of varied passages to read tonight. We commence in the second book of Kings and chapter 2. And we try and read as briefly as possible. 2 Kings chapter, towards the end of the chapter, we have Elisha going to Jericho in verse 22, healing the waters of Jericho. And then verse 23, and he went up from thence unto Bethel. And as he was going up by the way, there came forth little children or young boys out of the city and mocked him and said unto him, Go up, thou bald head, go up, thou bald head. And he turned back and looked on them and cursed them in the name of the Lord. And there came forth two she-bears out of the wood and tare 42 children of them. And he went from thence to Mount Carmel, and from thence he returned to Samaria. Now Jehoram, the son of Ahab, began to reign over Israel in Samaria in the 18th year of Jehoshaphat, king of Judah. And he reigned 12 years, and he wrought evil in the sight of the Lord, but not like his father and like his mother, for he put away the image of Baal that his father had made. Nevertheless, he cleaved unto the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, which made Israel to sin, and he departed not therefrom. And then the Moabites rebel against him. Verse 7, and he went, as Jehoram went and sent to Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, saying, The king of Moab hath rebelled against me. Wilt thou go with me against Moab to battle? And Jehoshaphat said, I will go up. I am as thou art, my people as thy people, and my horses as thy horses. Verse 9, so the king of Israel went, and the king of Judah, and the king of Edom, and they fetched a compass of 7 days' journey, and there was no water for the host and for the cattle that followed them. And the king of Israel said, Alas, the Lord hath called these three kings together to deliver them into the hands of Moab. But Jehoshaphat said, Is there not here a prophet of the Lord that we may inquire of the Lord by him? And one of the king of Israel's servants answered and said, Here is Elisha the son of Shaphat, which poured water on the hands of Elijah. And Jehoshaphat said, The word of the Lord is with him. So the king of Israel and Jehoshaphat and the king of Edom went down unto him. And Elisha said unto the king of Israel, What have I to do with thee? Get thee to the prophets of thy father and to the prophets of thy mother. And the king of Israel said unto him, Nay, for the Lord hath called these three kings together to deliver them into the hand of Moab. Verse 15, But now bring me a minstrel. And it came to pass, when the minstrel played, that the hand of the Lord came upon Elisha. And he said, Thus saith the Lord, Make this valley full of ditches. And then the Lord did deliver them as a result of the ministry of Elisha. Now chapter 5. This is the cleansing of Naaman. We don't need to read the details of that because they are well known. Naaman comes back and wants to give a gift to Elisha, and Elisha refuses. Verse 20, But Gehazi, the servant of Elisha, the man of God, said, Behold, my master hath spared Naaman the Syrian, in not receiving at his hands that which he brought. But as the Lord liveth, I will run after him and take somewhat of him. So Gehazi followed after Naaman, and when Naaman saw him running after him, he lighted down from the chariot to meet him, and said, Is all well? And he said, All is well. My master hath sent me, saying, Behold, even now there be come to me from Mount Ephraim 2 young men of the sons of the prophets. Give them, I pray thee, a talent of silver and 2 changes of ribbed garments. And Naaman said, Be content, take 2 talents. And he urged him and bound 2 talents of silver in 2 bags and 2 changes of garments, and led them upon 2 of his servants, and they bare them before him. And when he came to the tower, he took them from their hand, and or came to the hill, took them from their hand and bestowed them in the house. And he let the men go, and they departed. But he went in and stood before his master. And Elisha said unto him, Whence comest thou, Gehazi? And he said, Thy servant went no whither. And he said unto him, Went not mine heart with thee when the man turned again from his chariot to meet thee? Is it a time to receive money, and to receive garments, and olive yards, and vineyards, and sheep, and oxen, and men servants and maid servants? The leprosy therefore of Naaman shall cleave unto thee, and unto thy seed forever. And he went out from his presence a leper, as white as snow. Now just a little more, chapter 6. Verse 24, And it came to pass after this that Ben-Hadad, king of Syria, gathered all his host and went up and besieged Samaria. And there was a great famine in Samaria, and behold, they besieged it until an ass's head was sold for 40 pieces of silver, and the fourth part of a calf of dove's dung for 5 pieces of silver. And then we have the king very angry. Verse 31, Then he, the king, said, God do so more. Do so and more also to me, if the head of Elisha the son of Shaphat shall stand on him this day. And but Elisha sat in his house. Verse 33, And while he yet talked with them, behold, the messenger came down unto him. And the king said, Behold, this evil is of the Lord. What should I wait for the Lord any longer? Then Elisha said, Hear ye the word of the Lord. Thus saith the Lord, Tomorrow about this time shall a measure of fine flour be sold for a shekel, and 2 measures of barley for a shekel, in the gate of Samaria. Then a lord on whose hand the king leaned answered the man of God and said, Behold, if the Lord would make windows in heaven, might this thing be? And he said, Behold, thou shalt see it with thine eyes, but shalt not eat thereof. And that's plenty for reading, I think. And I can fill in the other details of the stories because they are all well known. We've already been able to cover some of the events. We're obviously not covering them all consecutively in a short space of a week, but we have thought on Monday night of the call of Elisha, and then on Tuesday night we were thinking about his commission and his company with the prophet Elijah. And last night we considered the care and the compassion and the concern that marked this man, his care for a widow and his compassion for the young man that was lying dead, and his concern for the sons of the prophets and the various difficulties that they had. And tonight we want to take a look at a different range of subjects altogether. I want us to think about the censure and the condemnation and the curse, some of the curses that Elisha offered. Now these are remarkable, because we all know that by and large the ministry of this man was a ministry of grace. He was a man of tenderness and a man of compassion, and what we were speaking about last night is really by and large the overall picture of the character of this man's ministry. But there were occasions when he had to speak very sharply, and we have read about those 4 occasions tonight in the meeting, and I want us to think about them. We're maybe doing him a certain amount of injustice. I hope not. If you've been here the previous nights, you will be able to keep the thing in balance. It's a little unfair to Elisha for us to be bringing these 4 events that happened at different stages in his ministry, to bring them all together into one meeting, and you would think that he was just a man that was critical and censorious of everything. He was not like that. He was a gentleman. He was a man of tenderness and compassion, but he was anything but a soft eye. There were times that he had to speak, and speak he did. He was a man, as we would say, in our ordinary common language, he was just as straight as a die. There were 4 evils that cropped up that I want to speak about tonight as briefly as I can in the meeting. First of all, I want to see how Elisha treated the sin of mockery. And then we want to see how he treated the sin of mixture. And then thirdly, we want to see how he treated the sin of materialism. And fourthly, what he had to say about the sin of modernism. Mockery, mixture, materialism, and modernism. He would be right up to date if he was just here in 1992. Where we first read tonight was just an event that took place shortly after Elijah had been taken up to glory, and Elisha has assumed the prophetic mantle from heaven, and he's taken on his ministry single-handed. Without Elijah, he has of course God with him. And he comes up to Bethel, and he begins to taste the first little flavour of opposition. He goes, the first place that he visits after he leaves the Jordan, as we all know, we didn't get commented upon it, and I'll not be saying much upon it tonight. He goes to the city of Jericho, and when he goes there, the elders ask him, bring a problem to him, and they ask him about the waters of Jericho that were barren and were poisonous, and he heals those waters. And then he leaves Jericho, and he comes on up to quite a difficult journey, quite a steep climb. And the next place on his itinerary is Bethel. But he doesn't quite have the opportunity of getting as far as the village or as far as the city of Bethel. And there's quite a crowd of young men come out to meet him. And they're anything but favourable. They call him names. Whether he really deserved the names or not, physically, I'm not sure, but they called him Old Baldy. And they made a bit of a laugh of him. I wouldn't want just to maybe say it in the meeting the way that they said it. Get out of here, Old Baldy! Get away! And they made a whole scoff of him. Go up, thou bald head. It's really a term of contempt, far more contempt than I would want to give it, because you might start getting contemptible, think that I was contemptible. But they just mocked the man, really because they had no appreciation of his message. And they didn't want him. He didn't force himself on them. He had to leave. But the strange thing was that when he was leaving, he turned round and he uttered a curse in the name of the Lord, and the two bears came out of the wilderness and mauled, maybe killed, but at least mauled 42 of them. So that Bethel was left with 42 young men less. They lost a good number of young people. Because they had absolutely no time and they had no room for the man of God and for the ministry of Elisha. There are a couple of lessons that I want to mention from that story that still speaks to us right down the ages. The first one is this, that very often opposition can come from an unexpected source. That's the kind of treatment that you wouldn't have expected from Bethel. If it had come from Jericho, you would just have said, well, what better could you expect out of Jericho? Jericho was a place that was the city of the curse from the very start. And God had to destroy it, you know, when the children of Israel went into the land of Canaan. And then, in recent times, it had just been built again in rebellion. And it was a place of the curse and a place of rebellion. And yet from Jericho there were people came to ask the help of Elisha, and they made him welcome. Bethel was the very opposite. It was a place that had a good name. It was a place that started off well. The patriarch Jacob he appreciated the house of God there and the presence of God there. But the passage of time has greatly changed the character of the place. And long since Jacob's day, there has been brought into Bethel the calf that Jeroboam put there. And the men that worship Jeroboam's calf, they have now produced likely as grandchildren, these young fellows that just come out and they call the man of God these very contemptible names. You know, it is a sad thing, and yet it's a true thing, that even down to the present day, sometimes the work of God receives strange opposition from strange sources. There are places now that years ago a man of God with an open Bible would have been welcome. There are places that have a good name, where in ancient times The promises and the presence of God were realized. But the passage of time has long since made a change. And they would come out, if the man of God was to come near now with the things that they would really need to hear and with the things that used to be appreciated there, you know what they would do with them? They would just mock him. And they would laugh at him. I was surprised, you know, sometimes at how many people would make fun of the very things that we appreciate very dearly. I'll not say very much about it, but there is one thing that I do want to say, that we can learn, as well as learning that opposition can come from a strange source. See, the Lord Jesus found that. Luke's Gospel chapter 19 is always a strange chapter to me. You're getting two cities in that chapter. Is one of them the same as what we're talking about, Jericho? The end of it is the city of Jerusalem. And you would say, now how is Christ going to be received in those two cities? If he's going to be received anywhere, he'll get a cordial welcome in Jerusalem. If he's going to be rejected anywhere, he'll be cast out of Jericho. You know, Jericho is the very place where there was a man received him joyfully. And Jerusalem was the very place where the tears ran down the face of Christ. For its streets were shortly to be stained with his precious blood. Opposition can be the source when it comes from unexpected sources. And when you do receive opposition, I might say this, and it might be helpful to someone, and when you receive criticism, and when you receive mockery and contempt, you always have to analyse who it comes from and who says it. You know, there's some times that I hear criticism. Well, quite a lot of it I hear. It doesn't do any harm. It keeps the balloon punctured, you know. If you didn't get some criticism, you would likely burst. But there's a good deal of it I wouldn't be concerned about, because the source from which it comes is just carnal. And if it just comes from the corner of calf worship, it never really gives you very much concern. And before I leave that, the second lesson that we can learn from that incident is this, that the sin of mockery is conceived in the Bible as very, very serious. I don't like to hear people making jokes about the things of God. You would say that it seems very, very strange that the judgment that these young men received was almost out of proportion to the sin that they committed. It didn't really deserve this. We would think that. But you know, it just shows us how much God takes a very serious look at those who make little of his messengers and of his message and of divine revelation. I just leave that. I don't want to labour any more on that point. The first great evil that Elisha had to deal with, and he dealt with it very, very strange, very severely, was the sin of mockery. I could follow it through. I could stay on with it. You might be interested to follow it through in your own reading. One of the strange things is that in the closing books of the Bible, there's great emphasis put upon the very fact that in the last days, mockers shall arise. We can expect it. Peter told the Christians, in the last days, mockers shall come, and they'll just treat the things that are so precious to you, they'll treat them with contempt and disdain. And Jude tells the Christians the very same thing, that mockers will come who will be sensuous, sensual, and so on. So we needn't be put off by this strange sin of mockery. The second evil that Elisha dealt with comes in the next chapter. We're told that when that was over, he went up to Carmel, and then he went to Samaria. It would have been quite easy for him to go from Jericho and from Bethel straight to Samaria, but he went to Carmel first. Carmel was the place of prayer. It was the place of intercession, and things weren't very good at Samaria. And I think Elisha knew before he would go to the capital, he would need to go to the place where his old master had prayed. And he went to Carmel, and then he came to Samaria. That's at the end of chapter 2. And just when you get into chapter 3, we're told that Jehoram, the son of Ahab, reigned in Samaria. Now, we have a very strange thing here in this chapter. We don't go into every detail. But Elisha finds himself confronted with a very strange meeting. There are three kings there. There's the king of Israel, a man called Jehoram. There's the king of Judah, a man called Jehoshaphat. And there's the king of Edom. You'd say, that's a strange mixture. I tell you, that's a strange mixture if ever there was one. The king, a son of Ahab. And then a noble son of Judah. And then, mixed in with that, the king of Edom. I nearly feel a little sorry for the man Jehoshaphat in there. And I ask myself a question, how did he ever get himself mixed into that kind of a conference? You know, good men do get themselves into some very awkward situations. Why did he get involved in that? Elisha didn't really reprove him so very much, but he spoke very sharply to the other man, to the man Jehoram. Because when the crisis came, the man Jehoram, he called for Elisha. I don't think he ever would have bothered calling for the prophet, you know, had it not been for the crisis. He just made a convenience of Elisha. But how was it that Jehoshaphat managed to be there? Well, you know, there were a couple of reasons. Jehoshaphat, we know from other reading and other passages of the Bible, Jehoshaphat was really a man that feared God and he wanted to do what was right. And generally speaking, in his life, he did that. But he had a weakness. And his weakness was just this, that I think that he was so much of a gentleman that he nearly had lost the courage to say no. And he found himself in this very awkward, compromising situation with two men on either side with whom he had absolutely nothing in common. Just because when they first invited him to come, he hadn't the courage to say, I'm not going. The same thing had happened a number of years previously to the same man. And before that, the same thing had happened again. And he found himself involved in very, very compromising situations. And the whole thing was mixed up. The alliance wasn't good. I would say to us all tonight, you be very careful about your associations. You know, God expects us to keep apart from everything that savours of evil. You see, the problem with King Jehoram was that he was a man who tried to ride two horses at once. That's no good at all. We're told that when he first came to the throne, that he put away the idol to Baal that his father had made, but he still kept the calves that Jeroboam had made. That is, he dealt with one part of evil, but he didn't deal with the other part of evil, and he tried to win everybody's favour. And then, when he was going out to fight against Moab, and you would say, well, wouldn't it be a good thing to fight against Moab? Aye, it was, sure. That was an honourable enough enterprise. But when he was going out to fight against Moab, he sent word to King Jehoshaphat, and he said, Jehoshaphat, I would really be delighted with the pleasure of your company, good man Jehoshaphat. And Jehoshaphat, gentleman that he was, he said, certainly, Jehoram, I'll go with you, and my people will just be like your people, and my horses will just be like your horses, and I'm 100% at your disposal. And Jehoshaphat should never have been there. Now, he was tempted to go because it seemed to be a good thing. One lesson that we can learn from the passage is this, that because there's a good motive, remember, that never justifies a false method. Sometimes I hear people say, well, you know, I know that I shouldn't have been there. And I know that I wasn't in good company. And tell you the truth, I didn't agree with them at all, and I really had very little in common with them, but you'll have to admit that we were all there and we were doing a good thing.
And it was a good job, and it was a good enterprise, and it was a good ambition we had, and I really went because the motive was good.
But remember, the end never justifies the means. I never justified conniving with mixture just because it has a good result in the outlook. The alliance wasn't good, and Elisha had to speak straight to Jehoram, and he said to Jehoram, "What have I to do with you?" I could say more about that, but I leave it as well. The atmosphere wasn't good. It's one of those interesting passages. I wanted to mention it before we leave the life of Elisha. That before he was able to give any directions, he had to get a minstrel to come to play some music. You say, why was that? You see, he couldn't get any communication from the Lord. And he sent for this minstrel, and the minstrel came and played music, and then the message came from God. Do you say why the minstrel there? What had that to do with the prophet? Well, I think I couldn't say very much about it or say anything very definite, but I think that not only was the alliance not very good, but you know, the atmosphere wasn't good. And Elisha needed the musician there to play a little bit, just to get the atmosphere calmed down. It must have been a very tense business. There were three kings with their armies, and they were just apparently, as they thought, on the verge of extermination. And the armies, the men of the armies and the cattle, the horses and so on, they were crying out for water. And they shouldn't have been there at all. And the whole thing was marked by exasperation and by frustration and by excitement and by very strange and difficult tensions. And God couldn't speak in a situation like that. The atmosphere was bad. You know, wherever you get mixture, you nearly always get a strange atmosphere with it. There's hardly any room in the whole thing for God to speak a word. And Elisha had to get the music to clear away that whole kind of thing and to get all calmed down. One of the strange things is that when the crisis did arise, and the three kings, they invited each other, Jehoram invited them, and they all went out on this enterprise, and they went for the 7 days' journey, and they ended up with a drought. Listen to what King Jehoram said. He cried out in despair when he saw the difficulty. And he thought that the armies were going to die of dehydration. Do you know what he said? He said, "Alas, the Lord hath brought these three kings and their armies together to kill us in the wilderness. Alas, the Lord has brought us to distress." He blamed it on the Lord, and the Lord hadn't brought them at all. The Lord never told one of them to go. He was the one that had organized and engineered the whole thing. And then when he got into difficulty, he just turned round and blamed the problem on the Lord. You know, sometimes there's a possibility that we could do that. Very often a Christian, we need to be careful, a Christian would take on some association that he shouldn't take on. And get into something that he should never be allied with at all. And then difficulties arise. And he just turns around and he begins to ask, "Why did the Lord ever let me down into this?" And very often we blame on the Lord things with which the Lord has absolutely nothing to do. It's just our own disobedience and our own mismanagement. This man Jehoram was just mixed up every way, and Elisha had to speak to him. The lesson that we want to learn from this incident, as I leave it, that God expects us to keep clear of everything that's half measure, of everything that's doubtful, of every kind of mixture with principles of evil that would not be for his glory. We ask our hearts the question tonight in the meeting: are you happy about all the alliances that you're in? Would there be any believer in the hall tonight, and you have any association that would not be in keeping with your position as a Christian? One of the sins that Elisha had to condemn was this sin of mixture with things, principles that were incompatible. The third evil that we mentioned, this one perhaps is better known, or at least this story is better known, and I want to emphasize it as well, is the evil of materialism. It's one of those great chapters of the Bible, 2 Kings chapter 5, that we often read in gospel meetings. But then there's the part of the chapter that we hardly ever read, and we wouldn't expect to read it in a gospel meeting, that brings a bright and glorious chapter to a very gloomy end. It's the man Gehazi. And when Naaman came back to try and encourage Elisha to take a gift, we all know that Elisha refused that. But Gehazi saw what had happened. And he thought that Elisha had missed an opportunity of a lifetime. And I want to speak here about the danger of materialism. Now we all know that this is a danger that to which each one of us is very much exposed in the Western society that we live in. And we want to look at it very, very seriously, because here's a man's life was ruined just because he succumbed to the temptation of materialism. When he saw, I want to first of all try and trace the various stages of the evils into which he found himself snared and trapped. And I use those words carefully, snared and trapped. Because remember, materialism is a snare. It's a trap. Most of the people who become involved in it, they find themselves more deeply entwined than ever they expected when they first began to go in that direction. And they get implicated in things from which they can't reverse. The Apostle Paul spoke about that in a verse that I'll maybe refer to just in a minute or two. And this whole problem, it all began in Gehazi's heart, because that's where materialism always begins. I want to think about the source of it. You see, when he saw Elisha refusing the gift, his mind just began to race at 200 miles an hour. And he saw the silver, and he saw the gold, and he saw the beautiful clothes all the way from Damascus. And he said, "There, my master has let those things go." And it flashed through his mind just in a few split seconds as Naaman began to go down the road and leave Elisha's plain little dwelling. It flashed through the mind of this man, "If only I could have got my hand upon a talent of that silver, what things could I not have done with it?" And he thought about it just a wee bit more, and this whole business began within his heart. And he thought about it, and he brooded over it. Now, he didn't lose too much time, because he knew that he was faced with just a wee bit of a dilemma. We'll have to try and get this picture as clearly as we can. If he went too quickly, that would give the game away. They would know that he had gone after something. If he stayed too long, Naaman would get out of reach and he'd be beaten. So just for a few minutes, I reckon that Gehazi had to think. Now, we don't know all that he was thinking just at that stage. But when he comes back to Elisha later on, Elisha says, he says, "Gehazi, was this a time to be getting silver and gold and changes of raiment and olive yards and vineyards and sheep and oxen and men servants and maid servants?" Why did Elisha say that? Because I think the prophet was able to see into the heart of Gehazi.
And he knew, of course, by the help of the Lord, being a prophet and so on, he knew that when Gehazi had left the house and had gone after Naaman, the one thing that was going through Gehazi's mind was, if I could get that silver, I could buy a vineyard. And I could buy an olive yard. And I could get a few men servants to work for me. And I could get a few maid servants to work for me. A prophet servant. Boys, if I could get that, I could farewell improve my lifestyle. And from the moment that Gehazi got a look at those talents of silver and those beautiful garments, changes of raiment,
contentment was gone for good. He never could be content again. And inside that man's heart, there began a festering, seething attitude of discontentment. And the only thing that he could think about was just this. If I could get those, I could fairly improve my lifestyle. Now, I want to speak about that for a moment or two. The Apostle Paul said in one of his epistles that godliness with contentment is great gain. There's always the danger that a Christian would find his heart beginning to succumb to thoughts like the ones that I have just mentioned, and would become discontented with his lot in life, and would get into his heart this idea, if I could only get those certain things, I could change my style of living. I could start to live like somebody else. I could step up a bit. Look at what I could buy. Look at the way I could enlarge my influence. Look at the things that I could get. If only I could get a little bit more silver, and if only I could get a little bit more gold. And once a Christian gets that kind of an idea into his heart, remember, it's dangerous. Now, it's the desire for it that I'm talking about. Now, remember, I'm not talking about the possession of wealth. Because there are people who have wealth, and God has given it to them. And we don't argue with that. But what I am speaking about, and I'm speaking about it very firmly, there's always the danger of a Christian desiring to live above his means. Now you be careful about that, because that ruined this man Gehazi. And if I take a station in life that's above my means, remember, it will ruin my contribution to the work of God and to the assembly. And if a Christian finds a covetous spirit getting into his heart without being judged, it will just ruin him as a child of God. Now I'm not concerned. I can say that honestly. I'm not concerned about what kind of a car that you drive. But I will say this. It would be far better for you to drive a second-hand car of poor quality. Than to try and aspire to a big automobile that's away beyond your means. I'm not concerned about what kind of a house that you live in. I'm not worried about how many rooms are in it. You can tell the Lord about that when you meet him. And I'll tell him the same about mine. It's not your business or mine the other way. I'm not concerned about that, but I'll say this. It'd be far better for you to live just in a very ordinary cottage with very ordinary carpet than to live in a sumptuous mansion with special furniture and to be aspiring to something that's away beyond your means and to lose fellowship with God. Now I wonder, is every Christian in the meeting tonight content? Here's a man on the sin of materialism. It blasted his life. And I look at him going out from Elisha's presence and he's going out just as a leper. And you say there's a man, and the rest of his life is lost. How many years of service could he have done for God?
What potential would there have been in this man Gehazi if the sin of covetousness and materialism had never got into his bones and never got into his heart? Now the point is this: when you feel the first thrust after materialism,
you judge it in the presence of God. And remember, all that we have and handle will soon be gone. And the houses we live in and the cars that we drive will soon only be a memory.
And we'll be swept into the great realities of an endless eternity where those things are absolutely nothing.
And away in the other world we learn the things that are real significance. And we believe in all these material things. So don't you get overexcited about them, because they're really not worth losing a great deal of sweat over. But that's not where it ends, you see. That's the cause of his difficulty. His heart, and he saw this, and he thought, if I could get that, I could improve my lifestyle. That's where it began. But then, it was one thing to want to get it. But when it came to the actual getting of it, you say, well, are you telling us then that it's not right to improve your lifestyle? See, we have to be careful. I don't want to be giving an unbalanced thing or an old foolish thing from the platform. You say, should I not get a better chair if I can afford it? Well, we'll take a wee look just at this passage. The problem was that in order for Gehazi to get the silver that he wanted, he had to go and tell a lie. What I'm saying is this. It wasn't possible for him to improve his lifestyle without sacrificing principle. Now, if you can do better without sacrificing principle, I'll not say a word about it. That's between you and the Lord as a steward. But you know as well as I do that alongside, not only is the source of materialism a covetous heart, but very, very often, I'm not saying always now, but when that thing begins to fester in a man's heart, he's going to need something to support it. And I can see Gehazi, and this thing that began within his heart, and the man's panting down the road now, and he gets Naaman's stuff. He says, sir, he says, I'll tell you what has happened. He says, I'll tell you what has happened now. He says, into my master's house there are two fellows have just landed, and they're prophets. And he said, Elisha would just love to have something to give them. And he says, if you could give me one of those talents of silver and two changes of raiment, it would just be a beautiful gift to send those two men. And if you wouldn't mind, I'm not asking. Oh, says Naaman, I'm glad to see you. He says, surely, take two of them. And he parceled them up. And there he is now. He has had to tell a lie. I don't think there were two people came at all. So here's a man increasing his assets, but his materialism hasn't only now become a covetous thing in his heart, but he has had to tell a lie. Did you ever tell a lie to increase your material things? Remember the lust that began in his heart and became a lie in his lips, it ended up being leprosy in his body. He tells a lie. I know believers that have done that. You say, but sure, believers wouldn't tell a lie. We're in a society where there's, in the business world, and I'm not speaking against businessmen, because if I was doing that, I would just be cutting the ground from my own feet. I was in business for years. And I know it. And I know the difficulties of, and I would say maybe more than a lot of people, I have a heart full of sympathy for businessmen, because their lives are almost impossible. And don't you be too critical of them, for it's not easy. Business is tough at the minute. And it's tough for a Christian. If you're a kind of a hook and a hangman, you could get through anyway. Business is not easy for a Christian. And you Christians who are not in business, if you have those in the assembly who are in it, pray that God will preserve them. But what I'm saying is this, we live in a world where to tell a lie in the business world is just perfectly acceptable.
And if it's financially advantageous, Don't be a bit afraid just to bend it a little bit.
Just when I say that, I remember just when I was in it, in business. I worked for a man, it's no credit to me this, but we had a problem. There were certain promises made to customers, and certain of the customers were doing dealings with the man that I worked for, with my boss, and others of them with myself, and the whole thing fell through, and there were going to be some very disappointed and irate customers. What are we going to tell them, Mr. C? I'll not mention his name. I remember going up to his office on the day, and he talked about it for a while. He said, we're in a spot here. Well, he said, I don't know. He says, you may go and tell your people, and he says, I tell mine. And he leaned back a wee bit, and I can see him putting his two hands behind his head yet, and leaning back in his chair. He says, at least, David, it's not too bad for me. He says, you're in a difficulty, for he says, I suppose you want to tell the truth, but he says, I can bend the truth a wee bit. He says, it's not too bad for me. Well, I said, Mr. C, naming him by his name, I said, the only problem that I would have, once I would bend the truth, it becomes a lie. You can't bend truth.
And here's a man, and he has just told a blip, and you, listen to what he said. Listen now. He said, as the Lord liveth, I will run after him, and I will take something from him as the Lord.
You say, yes, I tell me. Say, please, beg your pardon.
As the Lord liveth.
You say you wouldn't mention the Lord's name when you're going to do that.
You're going to tell a lie, and you're going to do something to him that you know is downright wrong. And you say, as the Lord liveth, here's a man still talking about the Lord
out of one side of his mouth and telling a lie out of the other.
But you say you wouldn't expect a man to be talking about the Lord and going to tell a lie, would you not?
You know, there are men could tell a lie on Saturday that would sink a nation. And unfortunately they could preach the gospel on the Lord's day. It never should happen. But it does happen.
And the lie left the man just a leper, and he got his two bags.
You say you're a wealthy man now, and he's coming back. But you see, once you start on the slippery slope, the thing that got into his heart and came out on his lips, now he has got these two bags. Well, he just has them in his hands, for he got two boys to carry them for him. 2 talents of silver. He's doubled up. Here's a good deal, you know. He thought he was telling a lie to get 1 talent of silver, and he has ended up getting 2. That's a good business. That's good business. 100% profit in the one day, even though I had to tell one lie for it. Doesn't matter. 100% profit. But the man has lost his testimony, and he has lost his communion with God, and he has lost the moral right to be an attendant of Elisha. Dismissed. Pack your bags and go out and live as a leper in isolation. You see the sin of materialism? But he comes back. And when he gets up near the city, he says, now look, boys, we can't go into the city. I don't let anybody see this. He says, come on in here and put it in here. Just outside the city. He says, well, keep this hidden. I don't go through the gate of the city, because that would be the place of administration, and if they saw me there, they would ask questions. Just put this here at the tower. Hide it in here. You know, that's what happens very often. That's another lie. That's the man acting a lie. And he has taken this money that he has got now because of lust and because of dishonesty. He's afraid that it would see the light. He can't declare it. You ever hear about money under the bed? I think that's what they talk about, isn't it? This wasn't money under the bed, but it was money hid out in the tower. He couldn't bring it through the gate. Don't let the administration know about it. I think, you know, maybe I should stop. I don't know, I'm pretty sure that it's not relevant maybe to anybody here. But you can all read the lessons very clearly. You know, if you have got money and you're afraid to show it to the administration and you're hiding it, it shows me that materialism has got the better of your soul. Well, I know the administration's hard to work with, And I don't think that they're always right before God. And I see a great difference between tax avoidance and tax evasion. And I might say that there are some Christians pay far too much tax because they're not careful enough about how to avoid paying it. But maybe I shouldn't be saying those things. That's tax avoidance. They never think of, they just hand, I'm talking about brethren that are being honest now. They're just giving away far too much. When if they were more careful, there are ways that that can be avoided, and that's not evasion. Evasion is wrong. That's the hiding, that's the concealing. And here's a man, and now he has acted, and now he comes into Elisha. And he's used the Lord's name in the whole thing, and he has brought the grace of God into disrepute. And he told Naaman that my master sent me here. He has brought the credibility of the man of God into the very dust. And he has sent the man away back to Syria thinking that the grace of God is not absolutely free after all. I got my leprosy cured, but it cost me 2 talents. When really it cost him not a penny. And the testimony in the name of God has been slurred. And the credibility of the prophet has been damaged. And the man has lost his own testimony. And he comes and he starts... I was going to use the word footering about... You'd hardly know what that means. Footering about in the house, kibbling about, you know, acting as if he was busy. And Elisha says, where were you, Gehazi? He said, I was just doing bits of things here. I was busy. And there he has told another lie. And the man of God just tells him his whole history. And it all falls out in the open. You know, there's one thing that I say to us all here tonight, and it's very solemn. I hope there's no believer in this meeting that's trying to live a double life. And if you're living a cover-up in any shape or form, it might do for a while, but there'll be an awful day of exposure coming. The lies only last for a while. And they leave a man cast out. I think it's a sad picture to see him going away full of leprosy. It's the same sin that put another man beneath a pile of stones. It's the same sin that put another couple lying just as corpses in the city of Jerusalem in the Acts of the Apostles chapter 5. It's the same sin that sent Judas hurtling down to the depths of eternal darkness. The awful sin of covetousness. And we are living in a world where people are very much tempted to improve their lifestyle at the cost of principle. And if your lifestyle, to get it improved, means that you have to tell a lie, all I'll say is this, keep your communion with God and just live with a little bit less. And you'll be serviceable. If Gehazi had left the thing alone, who knows? God knows. God only knows just what service this man would still have been left to do. But there's a line drawn here. The line of a leper. And we just have to leave it there with tears in our hearts and asking God for preservation. The last sin that I mentioned, and I don't want to go on, is not the sin of mockery or the sin of mixture and the sin of materialism. But Elisha had to speak to a man one day about the sin of modernism. It was a dark day in the city of Samaria with famine, and it was a day of economic distress. They were selling asses' dung. An asses' head for was it 80 pieces of silver. You wouldn't get much of a dinner out of a donkey's head. And to pay 80 pieces of silver for it, and a whole big bucket full of dove's dung for 5 pieces of silver. It was a day of economic distress, just like the world that we live. They were cutting up children, and they were boiling them. And the old generation was living at the expense of the young generation. It was a day of dreadful child abuse. It was a dark day. The city was being sieged by great hordes of from Syria, and the world in which we live, I cannot help but feel tonight, and the nation to which we belong, is really under satanic siege. And it's no wonder that Britain is just in the whirlpool of economic distress, because the nation has turned away from God. And these other things that have broken out and ruptured society and left it lying just as dismantled debris, they're because men have turned away from God. And then in the midst of it all, there's a king. He's a murderer. He threatened to murder Elisha. And then he's leaning upon another man. He's depending upon one of his counselors, the Lord upon whose arm the king leaned. And Elisha makes the great announcement that God's going to provide for them the next day. This man turns out, he's talking about God providing. He says, if God was to make windows in heaven, you wouldn't get corn here tomorrow. Don't talk to me about God and God providing. If he had to make windows in heaven, it wouldn't happen. Don't be talking to me about miracles. I don't believe in miracles. That's just, I'm rushing through it just to get the point over. That's why I called him a modernist. He was just right. This was a man that was full of modernism. You know, the world in which we live, they no longer leave any room for miracles. I'm talking about the men in power. As soon as you mention something that's miraculous, because of the modernistic flavour of men's minds, and they just think that they know everything, and they're rationalistic, they say because we cannot understand it, it just cannot happen. And we've got men all around us today, some of them deny the virgin birth of Christ. And some of them deny the bodily resurrection of Christ. And some of them deny the deity of Christ, and they're just modernists. But I think that we can take our place beside Elisha tonight, and we still appreciate that there's a great God. And there's a God who has all power. And there's a God who can still work miracles. And we can depend upon him. And the distress in the city of Samaria was really brought about to make men feel their need of Elisha. And I just close upon that note tonight. You know, I think that God will allow the distress in this world to become increasingly stiff, until at last, at complete extremity, men will be caused to turn and appreciate that there's only one man that is the answer to this situation. When it all began, Elisha was the least important man in Samaria. When the thing was over, he was the most vital man. The world tonight thinks nothing of Christ. But once they have spent 7 years beneath the mismanagement of the beast and the Antichrist, I tell you they'll just be crying out for the man from glory. And we are glad tonight that God has a man. And he'll soon be bringing him in a blaze of eternal glory. And he'll be hushing to peace the sorrows of a distressed world, and bringing the glory of Eden and the glory of the first creation to bloom again in the kingdom of his eternal Son. I hope that we'll be delivered from mockery. I hope we'll be delivered from mixture. I hope we'll be delivered from materialism and from modernism, for these were the blighting sins of Elisha's day, and unfortunately they are with us still. Shall we pray? Our Father, we commend our hearts to thee at the end of this meeting. We acknowledge humbly that thy word would leave us feeling very weak and helpless, and there would be a sharp and a searching side to it. And we pray that as thou wouldst wound us, that thou wilt heal us and help us to be complete and to be healthy Christians, and for thy glory. We thank thee for every assembly represented here. We thank thee for all thy care for thy people, for every material comfort that we do enjoy. We appreciate homes and health, and we appreciate all that we have in a temporal and material way, and we ask that thou wilt give us grace to hold it all in thy fear and in fellowship with thee, as we await the appearing of the Lord Jesus to translate us to a better world. We are before thee as we commit the meeting to thee and ask for mercies for the saints as we travel home, in the precious name of the Lord Jesus Christ. Amen. Just sing a verse of 393. 393, my Saviour, I would only, amid the world's proud scorn, the world that mocked and crowned thee with diadem of thorn. I think we just sing that third verse, "O keep my heart at leisure from all the world beside." Verse 3 of 393, and we may stand to sing.